Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today I am super excited about our topic. I feel like I say that every time, though, but this time I really, really am. We are going to talk about culture in Community of Christ, and on the podcast, we have our trusty Project Zion host, Robin Linkhart. So, Robin, thank you for joining me for this conversation today.
Thank you, Brittany. It's great to be here.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about culture in Community of Christ is on the podcast, we've talked a lot about history, we've talked a lot about theology, we've talked a lot about contemporary issues with faith, and something that we haven't touched a whole lot on is just the particular culture that thrives in Community of Christ. And so I, as you all are well aware, come from the LDS Church and am a convert to Community of Christ. And I interact with and work with a lot of Latter-day Seekers who are also interested in Community of Christ or who are joining Community of Christ. And there can be sometimes just a cultural learning curve, I guess I would say, when you are exiting one culture and one religion and then entering into another established religion with its own culture. And so one reason why I wanted to get Robin on this podcast in particular is because she grew up in as a military family. And so she moved around a lot in her formative years. And she's experienced the church in a wide variety of geographical locations. And then in addition to that, her work for the church has brought her to even more geographical locations where the church is located. And so I thought that she would be just a really good person to interview about culture and Community of Christ because she has experienced Community of Christ in such a wide variety of places. And so, Robin, thank you for coming on this episode. And why don't you just dive in and tell us a little bit about your background with Community of Christ? And like I said, all the different places that you've experienced the church in.
Okay, Brittany. I was born into the church. My mother was a member. Her parents were converts. My mom always said she was baptized twice. She was the oldest of five kids, and her mother was baptized when she was pregnant with my mom. So she grew up in Community of Christ, which was known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in those days. She married her best friend's brother, her best friend in high school, had a couple brothers, and the oldest brother was John, and she and my dad got married when my mom was 19, and my dad had already joined the military, and so my mom became part of a military family immediately. I was born in San Bernardino, California. My dad was already in Anchorage, Alaska. So when I was 6 weeks old, we moved up to Anchorage, Alaska from San Bernardino, and my parents attended the Anchorage congregation. My dad was not raised in a church family, although he carries a significant restoration heritage in his lineage. His mother was Addie Bernice Walden, a direct descendant of John Tanner, who was a convert to the church in upstate New York and went to Kirtland and had a significant impact and support for the church. He paid off the bank note for the Kirtland Temple lot, which was about to go into foreclosure. And so he helped save that lot for the Kirtland Temple to be built and was just a super supporter of the church in lots of ways. Ended up going out west to Utah. And his son, Sidney Tanner, was sent by Brigham Young to Southern California to plant the church. And so my dad's mother's side of the family was a direct descendant of that, but he was raised unchurched. So he joined the church when I was a senior in high school, but attended with my mom and with all of us kids faithfully all the years I was growing up. So we went from Anchorage to Rolla, Missouri, to Redlands, California, to Monterey, California, to Fairfax, Virginia, to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is the largest congregation we ever attended and had a full-time appointee in service there. We went to Dominican Republic, Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. We did not have any official church presence when we were there. So our little family, we kept our faith traditions alive, but we worshiped every week with other American Christians who were stationed in Santo Domingo and kind of formed this really cool little ecumenical group of faithful Christians. And somehow, I'm not sure how they worked this out, but I'm sure they pooled their resources and we had a traveling pastor who flew over, oh gosh, maybe once every month or two to shepherd us, and people stepped in on the other Sundays. From there, we went to Sidney, Nebraska, and then Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Graceland College campus, Longmont, Colorado, and Salt Lake City. So those are all the places where I was a member, or prior to baptism, you know, I was part of the group. We've lived in lots of different places. And with my time in the church, of course, I've served the USA. It has been my assignment area and have been in many, many states and congregations across the USA. Also have had the opportunity to provide ministry in Germany and England and French Polynesia and both East and West Canada and Mexico. So have experienced different cultures, non-American cultures of the church. And it's interesting to see how Community of Christ culture is in many ways very similar across an international field, and at the same time is enculturated and lived out in different ways and customs and colors all over the world. So it's a similarity and a diversity together.
So let's talk about some of these cultural aspects of Community of Christ. And let's first talk about the general world church culture that has more of a historical tie to the beginnings of the church.
Okay, so I want to talk about a phrase, a nomenclature that I heard growing up and I've heard on and off my whole life as people have referred to the early saints and specifically the early reorganization, and referred to that group of scattered people across the prairie and plains as a ragtag band of saints. This sense that we were a relatively small group of faithful followers who were spread around, who were just tough as nails in a way. We were going to stick to it. We were going to be the church that we understood and be faithful to that gospel. And of course, you know, we eventually reorganized and it was tough going. We didn't have a lot of resources, but people were determined. So that ragtag band of saints, like pull yourselves up by your bootstraps and make it happen. And I think as I have become more and more aware of the LDS tradition and those saints who went out west, there's a phrase that I kind of equate these two, and that is the shoulder to the wheel pioneer saints. And I'm hearing echoes of that same determined spirit. And I think when we study early church history, we see that obviously in the group of people that followed Joseph Smith. So that lived on through the reorganization. I think that lives on still in this spirit of volunteerism in Community of Christ, where everybody in the congregation steps in and does what has to be done. And it doesn't have anything to do with priesthood office or role or profession or who has the money and who doesn't have the money. It's like everybody steps in and helps out. And I have seen this over and over in my life as I grew up, you know, in the church. And I think it's instilled those of us who grow up with this. It's just, this is the way it is, a church. And we don't even think about it. And I think a lot of us don't even recognize that that may be particular to Community of Christ until we visit other denominations or we have new people joining, especially those who join as young adults or older adults. And it's something that we take for granted and then realize, oh, you know, maybe people don't like understand this or have this automatic response that we have. I had occasion to see this in action. Gosh, it's probably a couple years ago. I was at a World Church Leadership Council meeting at headquarters at the Temple in Independence, Missouri. And that council is made up of the First Presidency, the Presiding Bishopric, the Council of 12, the Senior President of 70, the President of the High Priest Quorum, the President of the Presiding Evangelist, the Director of HR. I may be leaving out one or two folks who are part of that group. So these are all what would be considered, you know, top level officials of the church. And we are in this big meeting room, which is called the conference room in the temple. And we got to the end of the meeting and we needed to change the setup for that room for what was coming next later that day. And we have been using less people for facilities than we have in the past. And so we didn't have people that work in facilities to do that. So Steve Graffio, who's a member of the Presiding Bishopric, stood up and said, okay, this is what we need done. And he went down a list of like 8 to 10 things that needed to happen, from stuff put away under the tables to the tables rearranged to this to that. And everybody spontaneously went into action just immediately. And we just teamed up, and Jen Kilpak from Communications was in there. And when we got done having the room set up, she goes, I think you've set a record. It took 7 minutes to get this job accomplished. So that's just an example of that spirit of volunteerism, regardless of who you are. When something needs to be done, we pitch in and do it. I also grew up with a really strong heritage of what was referred to as stewardship. And I think that's something that definitely comes from our expanded canon of scripture, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants. In particular, the Doctrine and Covenants of being aware of our resources and being responsible for those resources. And that responsibility is a mutual responsibility with checks and balances and accountability built in community with one another. And it extends beyond our financial resources into all the things that we have domain over, for example, on this planet Earth. And I think we see that stewardship spirit expressed in our enduring principles when we talk about responsible choices as well as sacredness of creation. And I think this sense of stewardship, wise spending, certainly was impacted by the Depression era in the U.S. And I remember one congregation I was in Tennessee, the pastor's wife, at the end of every potluck, would freeze the coffee that we hadn't drunk yet. And that would be warmed up and mixed in with the fresh coffee the next time. So just sometimes even what we might consider miserly, but just this awareness of how we use everything came through. And I think this sense of the ragtag band of saints that were tough and pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, this sense of stewardship and to be self-sustaining. So it was really important in congregational life that we made do with what we had, and we worked hard and we gave sacrificially for the betterment of the whole. And, you know, little groups. I remember the mission in Tennessee before they became a congregation. They met in a rented facility until they saved up enough money to buy a building and to have the, you know, monthly resources that they needed to take care of that. So stewardship was something that lived in the congregation, and it made its way into our homes as well. Some of the other things I think connecting with stewardship would be a sense of clean living. So the reorganization definitely had the word of wisdom. We received that as counsel, not by commandment or constraint, but it was something we talked about a fair amount, and people lived And when I say clean living, I mean, there was like no smoking, no drinking, you know, live healthfully, that kind of thing. There was a period in maybe the 70s, early 80s of, you know, back to nature. And I remember different women at potlucks talking about, you know, using whole grains and different things. And some people went as far as to make their own unfermented grape juice to use at communion, which was like, if you were at a congregation where they made homemade bread for communion and their own grape juice, I mean, we were like super holy, right? but I think, and in a sense, our stewardship of body was connected with this sense of word of wisdom, clean living. And that certainly has made its way into the present day through responsible choices. I think we have different understandings and biases related to that now. And certainly as we have wrestled with the use of intoxicants and the guidance that we've received in recent years on that, we see a change. When I was a little girl, I remember my mom telling me how when she married my dad, who was not a member of the church, that she was considered weak in the faith. So there was this unspoken culture for young people as they become young adults and are choosing their spouse. If a man married a woman out of the faith, he was not considered weak in the faith because it was assumed that she would be joining the church of her husband, and so this would bring a new convert to the church. For women, however, for a woman member to marry out of the faith, it was considered weak in the faith because it was assumed that that young man may or may not choose to join the church. It wasn't an assumption that that would happen. I thought that was really interesting. We don't hear that anymore in the life of the church, but it certainly was part of the culture in the U.S. when I was growing up. Another culture that I think is very, very much alive and well today is that in Community of Christ, this small denomination who has thrived and found their way into the future remains connected to one another all over the world to the point that I could go into any town or nation of the world, and if I needed help, I could find a member of the church and say, I'm a member of Community of Christ. My name is Robin, and I need help, or I need to find you. I mean, and people would come. There would be no questions asked, and people would come and treat you as if they knew you their whole life. We see that when we walk into a congregation for the first time and say, I'm a member of Community of Christ. There's just this automatic connection that is felt. And that's not to say that our congregations don't endeavor to warmly welcome every person that walks through the door regardless. There's just this sense of connectedness and trust and bond that we experience in Community of Christ that is expressed in ways that are so humbling because they're so rich and deep and so reflective of the sense of the Spirit living and breathing in us in ways that transform our relationships from generation to generation. Now, part of that connectedness is lived out in what I call the grapevine. And long before there were cell phones, and I don't even know how this happened, but something could happen at world headquarters and it would like travel on the grapevine and be known across the church in very short order. And in your congregation, of course, that grapevine was really effective. In your district or your stake, that grapevine across the church was alive and well. Of course, I think that is certainly the case today, but we have Facebook and all kinds of social media to help us. I think part of our connection to one another in older times made this grapevine alive and well. And, you know, we hoped that the information was reliable. And I'm not saying it was kind of the gossipy kind of stuff. It was like information of what's happening in births and deaths and family life and changes in leadership and just all kinds of stuff that would travel out across the church. Part of Community of Christ culture was connected with our appointee ministry, and these are folks who give their whole life to the church as employed ministers in the church. In the old days, they received elders' expense, which meant they had to account for all of the just wants and needs of their family and were reimbursed accordingly. As time went on, it moved into, you know, a salary situation where certainly Community of Christ employees are very modestly sustained, but certainly adequately sustained. But it is without that elder's expense accountability that was lived out over the years. But these appointees were such an important part of church life. And that was another part of our connection to one another, because almost always appointees were sent to places that were not their home area or where they grew up, but were assigned elsewhere. And this was a way for us to learn from each other. And oftentimes they were reassigned every 2 to 4 years across the church. And for the most part, these ministers were paid the highest regard and respect for their sacrificial giving to the church. And I think ministers that are assigned different areas today continue to be part of that connectivity from one place to the other across the church, and a source of strength and support. Definitely our World Conference tradition adds to that connectiveness, where especially today, people we're friends with on Facebook, we get a chance to meet them face to face at World Conference and hug one another and talk as fast as we can over lunch to share about our lives, and meeting new people at World Conference and become friends. Then we connect with them on social media or other ways over the years in between. And it's such a display of this unity and diversity. So this sense of oneness and connectedness, but yet it's expressed and embodied through our indigenous cultures. We get to see that at World Conference. So it's a tie that binds us periodically over the years. Used to be every 2 years, now every 3 years, something that we look forward to, but I think continues to inform and shape our culture as a people. Some of the older things that happened, we used to have something called Thus Saith the Spirit. Now, have you ever heard that referred to, Brittany?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
So was that in the context of your Mormon upbringing, or was that in the context of things you've heard since you came to Community of Christ?
Oh, no, since I've come to Community of Christ, but in the context of seminary and history classes and
yes.
Just hearing people talk about reunion and things like
right. that. So it used to be that if you went to a reunion and there wasn't a Thus Saith the Spirit, that you didn't quite hit the mark. And it was a way of, it was part of the culture and tradition. When I was younger, I heard about it. My family moved a lot and we were rarely located near a campground. So I did not grow up with the camping tradition of reunion. I was aware of that tradition, but we weren't living close enough to actually participate. We went to one reunion where my grandparents lived in Buckhorn, California, when I was in junior high. And that's the only reunion experience that I ever had. I did go to a few youth camps, but I heard people talking about this, Thus Saith the Spirit. And what that was is a minister would bring words to the gathered assembly and preface it with Thus Saith the Spirit, and then deliver something that was understood to be divinely inspired. Oftentimes people would try to take note of that and scribble it out, you know, as someone was speaking. I know at one point the church at large was counseled that anything that came under thus saith the Spirit was only appropriate for that gathered group. It was not something to be considered as continuing revelation or applicable in other settings. And eventually we just kind of dropped that tradition or part of spiritual experience over time. And in some ways it could be problematic. There weren't a lot of checks and balances with that, and it was something that could be abused in a sense or not necessarily appropriate and helpful to the group. But it was something I grew up hearing about. And back in the older days, now that I'm advanced in years, back in the olden days, of course, we had patriarchs and not evangelists and patriarchal blessings, and kind of similar to thus saith the Spirit, there was an expectation that in the context of a patriarchal blessing, one would be advised as to their tribe. And certainly, I know my mother and my grandmother were given their tribe. I did not have my evangelist blessing until 2008, I believe it was. And of course, by then, tribe was not part of an evangelist blessing, but there was a sense of culture for a long, long time of these types of things. And that certainly has been a change over time in culture. And the polity of the church, you know, how we're structured has changed as well. We originally had stakes and districts, and we had that up until about 2003 when we were reorganized into mission centers, which is what we have now. And I think some of the things that came out of district life and stake life have changed in mission center. And certainly, you know, priesthood, which I'll talk about a little bit later on, how priesthood are organized and how they are educated and how they keep up on their skills and bringing up new priesthood, how we do that has changed over time. Of course, when it was an all-male priesthood, there was a sense that all young men would be eligible to be in the priesthood, and fathers who held priesthood would often take their young, especially teenage boys with them when they were doing home visits. Young men were seen in a different light, understandably, and I think the church was vigilant. The congregational priesthood were vigilant in trying to mentor young men as they grew up. As we expanded priesthood to females, understandably that shifted a bit. And the first generation of us that went into the priesthood, especially those like myself who did not have fathers that served in priesthood when we were growing up, I kind of missed this unofficial mentoring that was part of our culture as a church. And that's something that's lived out, of course, in a very different way now. So I'd say that's, in a rough overview, that's some of the world church general culture that I have seen in my lifetime lived out in different ways. And I'm sure there are many things that others can add to that.
Thank you. That was quite a list and quite a journey that you just took us on. One thing that I just, I don't know, want to maybe re-highlight, this idea at the beginning when you were talking of volunteerism and self-sustainment and this idea that in congregations, in community of Christ, people just kind of get things done. And I have had the opportunity to go to different camps and reunions or to spec to see the church outside of my little bubble in Salt Lake. And it has been interesting to see just how there's like no questions asked. They just know what needs to be done. And it's not a stressful thing. It's just kind of something that is built into the culture so strongly. Whereas the culture that I come from, there's just top-down assignments and you're just kind of compelled to say yes to things and things things would get done, but they would get done in a very, in a way that, you know, you are told exactly what to do. But in Community of Christ, this idea that you step up and you want to step up because you care about the community, you care about the camp, you care about the event, you care about the potluck, you care about the worship service. There's a level of intentionality there that I think that I missed growing up, that I find really beautiful. And I think it can be a little bit overwhelming sometimes for new people that come into Community of Christ. But when it's actually lived out and you see it, it echoes, I guess, this idea of Jesus turning the kingdom upside down. Because I just remember, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but there was a Sunstone gathering, a Sunstone lunch a couple years ago, and you yourself and Locke Mackay were both at the Salt Lake congregation. And it was just fascinating to me because as we were cleaning up, we had one apostle in the back doing the dishes, and then we had another apostle in the back mopping, or in the front mopping the floor. And I just kind of sat there, and it just hit me in that moment that, like, this is how you build community. You know, it's maybe some of the two people that seekers would want to talk to more, or people that were visiting would want to talk to the apostles. It's like, well, you've got to wait till they finish mopping the floor or doing the dishes. And what an example of that, and what an example of servant ministry and just getting in and getting the work done. So I don't know, that part of Community of Christ culture, when you actually see it lived out in a congregation that just gets it, or at a campground that gets it, or wherever you happen to be, is just, it's, to me, it's really beautiful because it just connects to our history, connects to our journey as a people, and connects to our relationship. I mean, that's kind of how relationship is lived out in a way. And so I don't know. I just wanted to re-highlight that a little bit because it's really beautiful. Okay, so we've talked about some of the cultural aspects of World Church historically until today, but as we all know, Community of Christ congregations, they are not, I keep using this word correlated, which is a familiar word to our Latter-day Seeker listeners, but this idea that there's a centralized culture, that there's a centralized dictation of what congregations should look like, what they study, what they preach about, et cetera, et cetera. That does not exist in Community of Christ the way that some Latter-day Seekers might assume that it does. And so sometimes when I've been talking with seekers who are interested in Community of Christ, they want to know what exactly their specific congregation is going to be like, the one that's local to them. And that's really, really hard to describe because they're very different. So I want to kind of bring the conversation to congregational life and maybe talk about some of the aspects of the culture that are going to be different, and then maybe some of the aspects that might be the same, and then again, kind of weave in history and culture and just continue this conversation.
Yeah. So congregational life, that's where the rubber hits the road, right? And I love the fact that in Community of Christ, congregations put the flesh on the body. And it looks different in every place. There are personalities there, you know, of course there's different languages and contexts and cultures, and all of that's reflected in the congregation as well. But even, you know, in one nation, certainly United States has many cultures within the context of the nation, but even smaller nations, from each congregation to another, there's a little different personality. And I think that's part of the beauty of Community of Christ. At the same time, we have things that are very strong connectors. And I would say our hymnody has been part of the core of how we sing about who we are, and something that connects us since the very beginning. And of course, Emma prepared the first hymnal that the church used officially in the beginning of the church, and the reorganization has continued to carry that hymnody forward, to add songs to our heritage, and to actually prepare several hymnals along the way. The most recent one, Community of Christ Sings. We are a singing people, and it's very, very common in congregational life that singing is in four-part harmony. We're joyous, enthusiastic singers, and at World Conference, that's one of the things that we all look forward to is these thousands of voices from all over the world singing these songs that are so familiar to us, some of which have been generation after generation after generation with the church. The Spirit of God, Like a Fire Is Burning, for example. The Old Path, which is a treasured hymn of the reorganization. And in our most recent hymnal, the attention and sensitivity to capturing hymnody that is particular to certain cultures or places of the church, and doing that in a way that puts it in one hymnal for all of us so we can learn each other's special hymns. So that hymnody is seen in congregational life, and we've done things to help support small congregations that may not have a resident musician, a piano player, to have accompaniment music available digitally. But we certainly embrace all instruments in the life of the church. Another part of our culture is potlucks. And I think this is part of the early days of the church. And I'm going to speak to the early days of the reorganization, where we had scattered congregations. And in rural America, out on the prairie and plains, when people came to church, they were coming in from farms that might be miles away. So traditionally, we've had smaller congregations, and you go to the one that's closest to you, and you may have to go a ways. And I know even as a girl, when we lived in Pennsylvania, we drove 1 hour one way to attend the Philadelphia congregation, and that was a jaunt for us. So I can imagine that back in the early reorganization on the plains and prairies, that there was no question that families would be carrying in a part of a meal so that everyone could share a meal together while we were together on Sunday morning after the worship time, and then get back in our horse and carriage and go home. That tradition has lived on in congregations, and it's in some congregations is just so ingrained that you know without a question which Sunday of the month is going to be potluck Sunday. And that may be the same month, Sunday of the month that congregation has had potluck for 20, 40, 60 years, who knows? So that's something I grew up with and we look forward to. It's a time of sharing. It's a time of sharing recipes and tasting other foods and sitting around the table and just talking as long as we wanted to. And we got to know each other in a different way, because we had this table fellowship that was relaxed, unstructured time than we would have if we didn't have that. So things emerged out of our potluck tradition, like cookbooks that the women's department would put together. People would, maybe we would have a theme for potluck and we'd have like a Mexican fiesta potluck. But it was a special time. And my kids loved it. And kids would play sometimes for hours together during potlucks because the adults were having such a great time talking and the kids could just run around and do whatever. It was an unstructured time for kids as well. And they got to know each other better than if they had only been in their morning classes and worship. So that lives on. And I don't think I've been to a single Community of Christ congregation that doesn't have some form of potluck as part of their annual calendar. And that's a regular practice. It's interesting to note in the early days of the reorganization, and certainly in my young growing up time, we didn't call it Sunday school. We called it church school, which I think is really interesting. We'd have vacation church school. It wouldn't be vacation Bible school. I think that's part of our particularity as a people, how we understood disciple formation. It might even go back to the early days when we had, you know, the School of the Saints, the intense education that was provided for the priesthood, and I imagine for children as well. But church school was a big deal, and that eventually morphed into Sunday school, which is basically the same thing. But I think it was interesting that that was part of our culture, that that nomenclature, church school, was so important. That, of course, has gone away. We also had a structure of worship where we had an early morning worship. Have you ever heard of that, Brittany?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting thing as I was reflecting on culture over the years. In the USA, because that's my context, and we may have had it elsewhere, there was a tradition of having an early morning worship that started 15 minutes before church school. And generally, it was assigned to families, sometimes to individuals, but most generally to families. And you would be responsible for this little 15-minute devotion, if you will, but it kind of mirrored our practices in worship in abbreviated format. So there would be some hymn singing and some praying, some scripture, and maybe, you know, 3 to 5 minutes of expanding or reflecting on whatever the theme or the scripture was for that day. And the interesting thing about early morning worship, at least when I was growing up, is everybody could participate in that. Whereas in the regular worship, it was according to priesthood office, which of course was by gender, and also generally age, where children primarily didn't participate in worship when I was a kid. But early morning worship was this way to kind of include everyone. And as I look at it now, it was kind of a way to prepare people who might be providing ministry in worship. So a young priesthood member, this would be a place where they could kind of try out their wheels, so to speak, and hone their skills. I'm not sure when that kind of stopped. And I think I don't really know. It'd be interesting to do a study on that. We were still doing that in our Colorado congregation when my husband and I moved here in the late 70s. Well, I guess we moved here in the early 80s. They had early morning worship every Sunday. And I think, you know, as our culture around us changes in the world, that's reflected in our church culture as well. And so the early hours of church don't necessarily fit with the busyness of lives these days. We've also seen a shift in worship culture. So when I was a little girl, my mom played the organ and the piano in every congregation we were in. She was one of the people that provided that ministry. In some congregations, she was the only pianist organist, and so she did it every week. And I have watched this culture shift from what I call the breakfast napkin worship plan to where the pastor or whoever was presiding that day over morning coffee before they came to church, if you were lucky, would scribble down an order of worship on the breakfast, the paper breakfast napkin, and bring it to church. And he would lay that on the organ or the piano for my mom. So the first she knew of what hymns were going to be played and what order they would be in was when she received the breakfast napkin with the scribbled order of worship on it.
Oh, stressful.
Yeah. Really, I don't know how she did it. You had to stay sharp, right? There was a lot of extemporaneous worship ministry, even for those who brought the morning message. And in some ways, and I think this connects to the thus saith the Spirit, there was this unspoken sense that true, divine, holy stuff came only extemporaneously, that was a mark of, you know, how much spirit you had, how connected you were to the divine. We certainly had folks who obviously spent time preparing, and that was good. But it was much more freelance. We didn't have themes. We were kind of aware of a Christian calendar. We would not in any way, shape, or form even use the word liturgical. And our Christian calendar would probably only reflect Christmas and Easter. There was no sense of the revised common lectionary or the Christian calendar that would include such things as Lent and Advent and Pentecost, etc. So as the church moved into deeper understandings, new understandings of the Christian tradition and endeavoring, because we did have a very strong focus on education and being aware and informed of things and well-read, we began to embrace the greater Christian tradition and what we could learn from that. And we saw a shift in worship to where I think it was in the early 80s, and I might be wrong. Actually, it might be the early 90s when in the Herald, there would be one planned out worship for that month, or it was a brief outline, but something that would be what we would look at now as a worship help. And a beginning of having the worship office at World Headquarters have themes by Sunday. And then eventually we moved into using the Revised Common Lectionary, which rotates us not only through the Christian calendar, but through the different Gospels in the New Testament, and as well as the Old Testament. And then we added in our expanded canon, so we would pull in a reference from Doctrine and Covenants and a reference from Book of Mormon, hopefully that in some way connected to the theme that was represented by those lectionary scriptures, into what we have now, where we have a pretty comprehensive worship helps. That really changed our worship at a congregational level. And so we saw a shift in worship culture, so to speak. We certainly we're beginning to embrace more diversity of gifts in the context of that worship hour. And as we migrated away from that early morning worship experience where everyone was included and could express themselves in the context of that kind of laid back early morning abbreviated worship, you began to see more expression in worship, the main worship hour. And of course, with the addition of women as priesthood, that integrated even more giftedness. But we began to see how children were invited to participate in different ways. And not only members, but friends of the church were invited to participate. We began to embrace things that prior had been seen as kind of heretical. So responsive readings. I mean, there was a time in the life of the church that would have been seen as absolutely not okay because it was Protestant, or lighting candles, which God forbid, that was Catholic. So we just went through an awareness and understanding of the greater Christian tradition that began to bless us and become part of our traditions of worship. And that also has added to the personality of congregations and what it is that congregations embrace as being relevant and meaningful in worship that can be very different in different places. So that creativity of worship has been a nuance that has begun to live in full color. And of course, as I mentioned, with the expansion of priesthood to embracing the giftedness and ministry of women, that certainly has caused a shift as well, a deepening and expanding in our worship, but you know, throughout the life of the church. So it's impacted the culture of congregational life. Back when we had a male-only priesthood, we had a very active women's department, and you can read in the history of the church how women were on the floor from the beginning and playing an active role in supporting the life of the church in lots of different ways, as well as creating avenues for more revenue to come into the church. So they would use their gifts and talents to do things that would raise money for the church. Women were authors of curriculum for the church, and the local women's department was always working on some kind of project that enriched the life of the congregation. I don't know that there are that many active women's departments in our congregations these days. Certainly here in Longmont, Colorado, they had a women's department when we first moved here in 81. But I would say within 10, certainly 15 years after that, we didn't have one, and it wasn't nearly as active. So that activity of women, I think, has been expressed through the whole fabric of the life of the congregation and not limited to a women's department. And so women's departments in general, I think, have kind of faded out, although we still have women's ministries and certainly women's retreats often. We also had something in congregational life called Zion's League. Have you heard that one?
Have. Again, yay. Because of seminary.
Right, right. So Zion's League was the youth group, generally teens, junior high, senior high, and sometimes, depending on the congregation, might be your senior high or your 9th through 12th grade group that met at least once a month, would have different things that they did together, both in the church and outside of the church. And, you know, that kind of connects with our camping tradition.
So one thing that I think is, again, important to highlight is this idea that church doesn't need to be so gendered. You talked a lot about when we had an all-male priesthood and how a lot of those roles and positions for worship planning and preaching and teaching, et cetera, were predominantly male because of priesthood. And it's interesting to me that, well, one of the biggest questions that I get from Latter-day Seekers is, well, what about Relief Society or what about the women's groups? And it's hard to articulate why that's not as needed in Community of Christ, because women are actually given an equal voice. They're given an equal opportunity to be engaged in congregational life, whether they are priesthood or not. And so this idea that women would have to gather, and I don't know how to word it, this idea that women would have to gather and take care of themselves and have their spiritual needs met in a very focused or funneled way just doesn't quite exist, because the sexes in Community of Christ work together consistently and constantly, and they work really well together. And women, their ministry is accepted and their ideas are accepted. And I am speaking in general terms. I'm not trying to say that sexism doesn't exist in the church, because it exists everywhere. But in general terms, their giftedness and their understanding of the way that a congregation should run and a congregation should worship, et cetera, is at the same level as a man's. Like there's the same credibility as a man's. And so I know that when I first came to Community of Christ, that was almost alarming, I would say, because in my LDS experience, I was so used to Relief Society and this idea that I could only be spiritually free among women. And it took me a little while to really understand that I was accepted and valued and cherished and believed and, you know, all the words, just as much as my husband, which kind of made my need to congregate weekly with only women, that need just faded pretty fast, because I wasn't afraid to speak up in Sunday school, or I wasn't afraid to help plan worship, or I wasn't afraid to question or learn why things were working in the congregation, because there wasn't this patronizing, oh, well, you're a woman culture that I had run into time and time and time again in my Mormon experience. So that's just something that I wanted to comment on and highlight, because again, and I know that it doesn't always work out beautifully in Community of Christ congregations. I don't mean to paint that picture. But overall, the giftedness of women in Community of Christ and how that giftedness is used for me has made those female-only spaces maybe less important.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I love the way your traditional heritage that you grew up in affords a lens for not only how you see it, but how you experienced it as you transitioned into Community of Christ. And I think certainly that has impacted how needs are met and filled. And I think along the way, we've had to re-understand that there are some needs that are connected with gender, and that certainly we need to be vigilant and aware of needs. And sometimes, for example, I think women's retreats have remained to be an important part of what we do in Community of Christ, because there are times when women need to be together and kind of debrief life. And I think the same is true for men, and that each gender defines for themselves, you know, what that needs to look like. The other thing that's particular to Community of Christ in contrast to the LDS tradition is that not all men, when we had an all-male priesthood, were automatically priesthood, and not all females are automatically priesthood. Priesthood is a process of calling and response. And so what that created in Community of Christ is something that's kind of interesting. And I heard men talk about this when I was a kid, and that is, no women were priesthood, and some men were priesthood, but not all men. And men would say, if they did not hold priesthood, that they were a member of the third sex, because they were the men who were members, but not priesthood. So it created this category of people who may have felt, in a sense, left out. And what their experience was in the life of the church as a member who was not priesthood as a male would be interesting to hear people share about, because worship largely was something that only priesthood members participated in, as far as bringing it to the congregation. You know, each of the priesthood offices had a different role, so to speak, in the order of worship, how that was lived out. Really interesting. So this shift to including women, and which I think was the leading edge of a shift to embracing the giftedness of all, and not only the giftedness of member, regardless of age, but also friends of the church, where so many different people are included in the life of the church and also in worship, is very interesting.
Yeah, I do want to comment on that really quick. This idea of friends of the church being included in the congregation. We have, in Salt Lake, we have visitors, new people coming every single week. And we have several people who are involved in the congregation who have been with us for well over 6 months to a year, et cetera, who have jumped in, who are teaching Sunday school, who are playing the piano every Sunday, who are helping teach the kids. They've taken youth worker certification, who are counselors at camps, et cetera. And we had a visitor this last week that I was talking to, and she was surprised when I was talking to the woman who happened to teach Sunday school, and she learned that this woman wasn't actually an official member of Community of Christ. And this visitor was blown away that we would allow a, you know, quote unquote non-member to teach Sunday school, when in reality, this woman who's teaching Sunday school, she's been with us for over a year now, and she's perfectly capable of teaching the Community of Christ identity, message, mission, and belief. And she's, her lack of membership does not stop her from contributing in meaningful ways in the life of the congregation. So I'm glad that you brought that little sentence up, because that was something too that was very different for me coming in. This idea that I could be planning worships before I was even a member was just something I was not expecting, but that really was very, very meaningful to me. So you did mention a little bit about camping, and camping is something that we've talked about on Project Zion before, but it is a huge part of Community of Christ culture. And so let's dive into it. Take it away.
Yeah. So first of all, I do want to say we have a great episode on Project Zion about reunion that goes into all kinds of stuff, including the history. But I will just say that in the late 19th century, these scattered congregations of saints wanted to get together. We had conferences and people came together, pitched tents, and began this tradition of reunion, which now in the life of the church generally happens in the summer months, although we do have some reunions in other parts of the world in January or December. And some places in the U.S., we have reunions of retired folks that meet in January or February, especially in Arizona where it's warm. So this reunion, or sometimes we call it family camp, is a time once a year for most folks where everybody gets together. We own many campgrounds across the world. Where we don't own campgrounds, people rent facilities to get together, to play together, eat together, have campfire, have worship, have education, all kinds of different recreation opportunities as well as creative outlets. It's a time of drawing apart from day-to-day life and focusing on our relationship with the divine, with the one whose name we claim and carry, to focusing on our relationships with each other. Sometimes when we're at reunion, we're going through a hard time in life, and it can be a time to spend in quiet meditation, or perhaps to spend time with a trusted mentor or friend and talk about what's going on. Campfires are a real important part of that reunion experience. Campfires that start with funny songs and skits and laughing and move into a serious time of watching the fire and listening to the sparks as the wood snaps and pops, and we sing reflective, meditating songs. We may share a testimony of how God is moving in our lives, and certainly prayer is part of that time. Generally, reunion is a time where we are more in touch with nature, the world that God created, because most of the places that we gather for reunion are out away from city life, and in an area where there aren't a lot of people. And so whatever the indigenous nature is where we gather, we get to be with those trees and flowers and birds and bees and all kinds of things. Children form these deep relationships. Again, we live out our volunteerism at our camps, where we all have a turn at KP, kitchen duty, prep or cleaning, and the bathhouses and our cabins and all of that is part of our responsibility, and we trade off. And lots of times we're serving on teams with people that we don't know, and so we get to know each other as we're running the dishes through or doing the pots and pans, which is another important part. Reunion often is a time where people have some of their deepest spiritual experiences or encounters with God. For those who week in and week out are supporting congregational life, it's a time to rest in the ministry of the whole, a larger group of people. We often have guest ministers come in. We get to know new people and hear different stories of how God is making a difference in people's lives. It has become a core experience in the life of the church, a deeply meaningful and spiritual experience. It's a time of, in a sense, an endowing of the Spirit, where collectively in community, we experience a deep awareness and sense of the Spirit moving. And often as individuals, we can have just pivotal key moments of experience in the context of reunion or family camp. Over time, that branched out into camps for different ages, children and youth camps, and also retreats, men's retreats, women's retreats, priesthood retreats, congregation retreats or sometimes special focused retreats. I know some parts of the nation have arts and craft retreats or music retreats. In short, it's a camping tradition that provides an opportunity for us to draw apart from our everyday lives and to focus our attention on our journey of faith and building community together.
I also know that I have said this a million times on the podcast, but reunion was the first experience that I had with Community of Christ, which ended up being obviously a good thing because here I am. but it was interesting to try to figure out this camping culture in Community of Christ. And shortly after that went to a women's retreat, and women's retreats have continued to be a pivotal and foundational activity that I've been engaged with in Community of Christ. And I think that there's something just really special and sacred about camping with people, worshiping with people, eating with people, cleaning up with people, day in and day out, whether it's just for a weekend or for a entire week, like reunions often are. There's a level of depth that you can go into with a human when you are spending that much time with each other, I guess for good or for bad, but hopefully it's generally for good.
Yeah, we often say that reunion in particular is an opportunity to experience Zion, experience the peaceable kingdom, experience the reign of God in this very community-focused, God-centered time together. And it is, in many ways, we have flashes of seeing the already not yet of the kingdom of God. And it's exciting. It's exciting to vision that in a very tangible way.
So let's also talk about Graceland University. I know that this idea of being a young adult in the church is something that we've talked about a lot on Project Zion. We have a whole series called Chai Can't Even that's been a delight to just get to interview people in Community of Christ who have grown up, who are young adults. And Graceland is usually a big part of that story. So let's talk about Graceland.
Okay, so Graceland College, now known as Graceland University, was founded in 1895. It was a two-year college for a period of time. In 1910, they added the nursing program, which has been a really important part of Graceland University over the years. Eventually established the sanitarium, which was a nursing college in Independence, Missouri. So women, generally women, men, of course, go into nursing as well, but would start their classes at Graceland College, and then they would be up at the SAN, the Graceland SAN in Independence, and do their clinical training, etc. And the nursing program in Graceland University is one that is well respected across the USA. And now we have an education program through Graceland that also is one that is held in high esteem nationally. And now we have also master programs available through Graceland University, including the Community of Christ Seminary, which is part of Graceland University. So Graceland College, founded in 1895 in Lamoni, Iowa, up on the hill. Now, Iowa does not have what I from Colorado would call hills, but when you're on a flat land, you can kind of see a rise in the landscape. And Graceland is on the hill out there. And of course, this was a residence college. So kids traveled from far and wide to come and be a student at Graceland in Lamoni, Iowa. Population in Lamoni now is probably about 2,000 people. So it's a very small town. And Graceland became a core experience for youth in Community of Christ and has been upheld for generations as the college that many people are encouraged to go to. I know when my mom was growing up, if you wanted to find a spouse that was a member of the church, for most of the people of the church, you went to college at Graceland if you could. because this is where young adults from all over the church would be attending. And if, like some of us who grew up in congregations that met in a farmhouse with 12 people, you weren't likely going to find a member of the church spouse in that kind of situation. So it's been shaping and forming. Graceland has always had a very active campus ministry program, and many, many people have met their spouse at Graceland. And what has happened out of that is Graceland, in a sense, is a similar experience to camping tradition. I know even my nieces and my own kids who went to Graceland said, oh, it's just like going to camp, except for a long, long time. But there's this sense of, you know, being together. And because you're kind of isolated in Lamoni, Iowa, out there, and certainly in earlier times where very few of us had a car at our disposal, we were pretty much isolated out there. We were stuck out there on the hill, and became very, very close. And that sense of connectedness and deep, deep friendships that are made at Graceland continues. And we see generation after generation of folks who attended Graceland together having lifetime friends, and they keep in contact with each other in a very active alumnus program. So alumni go back, Graceland homecoming in the fall, lots and lots of different ages of Graceland alumni flock to Graceland at homecoming and reconnect with one another. It's also a place where the international life of the church is seen. When I went to Graceland, that's the first time I got to meet kids from other nations that were members of the church. And of course, we also had people attending Graceland who were not members of the church. And that percentage has grown now. I think 50% or more of the student body at Graceland now are not members of the church. We've got lots of sports. Volleyball was a really big sport at Graceland, and our Graceland Sports Spectacular, which is called Graceland Spectacular now because it's more than just sports. The annual summer gathering for teens started out as a volleyball program, and volleyball was a big sport at Graceland. Of course, they have lots of different sports, so they recruit athletes from all over the place, and many of whom are not members of the church. So it's a great international presence as well as diverse presence. They had a tradition at Graceland called Ring by Spring. Now, I doubt very much that you hear a reference to Ring by Spring nowadays, but I would bet that they still have candle passings. So Ring by Spring meant for those that attended Graceland, and this certainly would be a generational thing as the role of women in the world has shifted over the decades, but women who went to Graceland were hoping that they would have been, have received a proposal by spring, and that they would have a ring by spring. And the candle passing tradition was connected with this. Whenever a woman gets engaged at Graceland and they receive an engagement ring, they would secretly go to their house president. We don't have sororities or fraternities at Graceland, but everybody is part of a house, which usually is your floor of the dorm, or your living arrangement is a house that has a name. You would go to your house president and secretly tell her that you were now engaged and you wanted to have a candle passing, and you would entrust your engagement ring to her. She would post all over the dorm, candle passing at Ananta or whatever house you're in tonight. And that usually happened, you know, 9-10 o'clock at night, and everybody would come to the lounge, and we'd be in this huge circle side by side and super excited, and the candle with the ring tied to it would be lit, and that would go from woman to woman around the circle. Sometimes it would go a couple times around the circle. Sometimes young women would take a deep breath and pretend like they were going to blow it out, but it wasn't them. And everybody would go, And then it wasn't. But eventually the young woman who had become engaged would blow the candle out, which meant she was the one. And of course, everybody gathers around her with hugs and congratulations. Now, I don't know for sure that candle passing is still a thing, but I guess it is. Have you heard, Brittany?
I have heard from people who are not too much older than me. I'm trying to think. Emily Rose is a couple years younger than me, and I'm trying to remember. I know we've talked about it, and I can't remember if it is still alive and well, but I think I would not be shocked if it is still a thing. Probably not as taken seriously as maybe it has in decades past, but
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a really fun thing. Super fun. I did not have a candle passing when I was at Graceland. I was only there 2 years. I do remember my boyfriend, who is my husband now, gave me what we call the promise ring. So it was a ring with a little tiny diamond in it. And I remember showing it to my roommate back in the dorm, and she goes, oh, you should have a candle passing. I said, no. Maybe he intended. No, he did not intend. So anyway, college is important, and education, as I said, is important in Community of Christ. And we had campus ministries called Liahona at other campuses where we had a presence of Community of Christ students. I graduated from high school in Rolla, Missouri. University of Missouri, Rolla is there. And we had several students, and some of whom I've run into since then when I was in high school, and they were part of the Liahona, and they attended our local congregation. And I know my parents were active in supporting the Liahona, often had the college students over to our home for meals. My mom, as a musician, would get them all together and propose that they learn several Christmas hymns so they could sing for Ministry of Music. And I remember singing with them sometimes, you know, as we attempted to harmonize together. So Liahona ministries have been an important part of the life of the church on college campuses. I'm not sure where we are with that. I don't hear about Liahona much anymore. Have you heard anything about that?
I don't think I have, actually, like, at all. So
now, I know when we were in Transformation 2000, which launched in 1997, the summer of 1997, we had some transformation ministers who were specifically focused on campus ministry. And it seems to me we had someone in Michigan that did that with Liahona. But certainly it's not something we hear talked about a lot anymore in the Community of Christ, but it was very, very viable for a long time. And I think tried to parallel that sense of connectedness and community that Graceland students experienced, and wanting to support our college students wherever they were and connect them with local congregations. Now, we still are very active in doing that, being aware and supportive of college students who are members of the church, regardless of where they are. I think you have some graduate students out your way in Salt Lake City, don't you?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, which has been really beneficial for the congregation, just to see and get to meet lifelong Community of Christ members, because so many of us are brand new to the church. And so to have that just insider perspective, I guess, if you will, has been mm-hmm. really, really good. So one thing that I hear you saying over and over and over again through this conversation, Robin, is that our culture and our theology and our identity is all intertwined. And the themes that I'm picking out most strong, I guess I should say, is community. That so many of the things that you have touched on come down to just being together in community and worshiping God and fostering relationship in community. Everything from this idea of volunteerism, everything from holistic living, and maybe looking at the word of wisdom and what does that mean and what does that look like, and what does it mean to communicate as a community, as a church, as a body. How do we make decisions? How do we minister to each other, and with what I don't know, level of authority or severity of authority? How do we integrate women and other marginalized groups into our worship and church experience? How do we come together when we are not meeting on a Sunday, whether that be camping or at college, et cetera? What other ways can we be the church, be the community outside of just Sunday morning worship? And these are all things that I have really, really have caused me to fall in love with Community of Christ. I do love a traditional morning worship service, but what drives that moment is what happens in the week, or it's what happens when we get together at potluck, and it's what happens when we foster relationships at reunion, et cetera. And for me, it's those experiences that kind of bring me to Sunday morning worship with this community that I have fallen in love with. And that was one thing that I experienced at World Conference. We've talked about World Conference quite a bit. And this idea that I could get to know people online, or I could get to know people through the podcast, which I guess is a form of online, and then come together and have this worship experience, have this common consent experience. And it was all fostered on the foundation of community. And I mean, I will say that that is something that was not the foundational experience that I had growing up in church as a child. It was more a belief or a theology or a doctrine or a way of thinking that is what kept us grounded together. And I think that sometimes the community aspect was put aside a little bit for the sake of the actual institution or the set of beliefs. Whereas in Community of Christ, everything, I mean, it's almost the reverse of that. Everything is decided upon as far as theology, as far as continuing revelation, all of those things, our identity, our enduring principles, our mission initiatives, those all came out of community and how we interpret the gospel together, which I think is just incredibly beautiful and filled with hope, because from my perspective, we're able to look together into the future together. Like I think you said at one point in our conversation, you talked about the personality of congregations and how that can change and evolve depending on where you are in the timeline of history and geography, et cetera. And to me, that's what I see Community of Christ as a whole doing, that together we can worship God and we can further our deepening understanding of where God would have us go. And that is all grounded in community. And I think that it's lived out really, really well in the culture of Community of Christ.
Yeah, I agree with you that it brings great hope. So I think who we are as a church and how we are as a church is so organic that by the very nature of our DNA as a movement and how Community of Christ has felt called to respond and live that out, is such that it can move and become and be the church wherever we are, in whatever time, whatever environment we find ourselves in, and as we live into the future in a world that's changing so rapidly. I think we can rest in the knowledge that who we are and who God calls us to be can continue to thrive and be expressed faithfully in our world. It may look different. It may be expressed differently, but it's true to the song of who we are as God's people. So it kind of goes full circle to our hymnody. We can sing the song of who we are in the fabric of our lives and be our authentic selves faithfully as a people of God and walk into the future assured that we can be the church wherever we are called to live and work and play. And it is a beautiful thing that indeed rests on our sense of community with one another, centered on God, our Creator, and share that with people all over the place.
Yeah, because I think that God, spirituality, and community will always be relevant. Mm-hmm. And it, like you said, it might look different as we move forward into the future, but that's okay. And that that sense of change is almost predictable in our faith movement since the beginning, which again, just kind of helps us live into our identity even more. Mm-hmm.
And even in the midst of change, there's this essence that remains the same, mm-hmm. generation after generation. It's an essence that is central focus, absolutely God-centered, and yet such a firm foundation that it can change and be expressed in multiple ways and still carry that essence.
Well, thank you, Robin. This conversation was great, and I was just telling you that I think I want to do a follow-up with Nancy Ross. We've talked about doing a podcast on Community of Christ culture and how we, coming into the church as Latter-day Seekers, experience that culture and that cultural shift and understanding in our own unique ways. So I'm excited to continue the conversation in multiple podcasts about Community of Christ culture, because I think culture is such a deep part of our identity that it's a piece of who we are. It's a piece of the puzzle with our history, with our theology, et cetera. So I'm glad to get this conversation started with you.
Well, thank you for having me. Thanks for the conversation. Thanks for everything you bring to that conversation as well. And I am really looking forward to listening to your conversation with Nancy Ross. That's going to be a wonderful one.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.